Today is May 24th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Radio Show, and I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM on the Internet, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio in New York at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, PCRadioshow.org. It's a great day in New York today. Beautiful weather. And Joe, how you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good now, thank you, Hank. I wasn't in quite the shape I wanted to be to come down to the station, but thanks to Ma Bell...
Listen. I know why you're not here. There are two reasons. Number one is great weather, and I understand the Mets won last night.
The who?
Okay, you don't follow baseball.
I do follow baseball. I just don't follow professional sports.
Okay. Hey, listen, I understand that you got a phone call today about...
Hey, yeah.
Yeah? Go ahead.
Did you know that Well, let me tell you about the phone call. Phone rang, picked it up, asked for me by name. I acknowledged my presence. They said that this was advanced tech support at Apple. Apple advanced tech support. They had a security breach at their end, and my name had gotten, what was the word that they used?
Well,
at any rate, the essence was my name had gotten into it, and they wanted to help me re-secure my system. At which point, I knew what Hank and I have been telling you time after time after time on behalf of Microsoft, but it was also true of Apple. They, tech support, will not call you in such a case. But I wanted to find out what they had in mind, and I said to them, I do indeed have a couple of Apple products. I have the iPhone 7, and I have an iPod. Which were they talking about? And they said, well, I do have a computer, don't I? And I said, not an Apple computer. They said, oh, that doesn't matter. Do you have a Windows computer? I said, yes. They said, well, would you sit down next to that and turn it on and no, they didn't say turn it on. Sit down next to that and follow our instructions. I did exactly what I would hope that all of you would do. I said, oh, that wouldn't be possible at the present time, but if you'd like to tell me what to do later, I'll be happy to look into it. We finally agreed they would call me back tomorrow, and tomorrow I might have a different story for them. But the point I'd like to make is we were up till now knowing that this type of a scam was going on in order to get access to a Windows computer. This is a new pitch.
Well, what makes it unusual, Joe, is that they're saying they had a problem, not that you had a problem.
And, yes, exactly.
And normally that put your defenses down because saying, I know I don't have a problem. Oh, you have a problem. Maybe I can help you.
No, they were saying that my account had been compromised because they had been broken into.
Right, they had a problem. That's what they're saying. And that's a new twist.
They have another problem. They have another problem because I wouldn't swallow the fishing hook, and the bait got away. It was a scam call.
Yeah.
There are a lot of scam calls. I don't care if you're running Apple or any of the subdivisions of Apple, Macintosh. I don't care if you're running Windows or if you're running Google, Android, Fascia. I don't care what you're running. Rest assured that if you get a call about security on your machine, it's not legit. It, with one exception that I found when I was doing some research on it. If you're part of a network, like a college network or your business network, you might get a call from internal tech support, not from Apple, not from Microsoft, but at your university or at your business, you might get a call from their tech support. And I'm sure that you have ways of identifying that as a legitimate call.
Well, by the way, the easy part is just say, I will call you back at the authorized number. That's all you have to do. In other words, you don't have to continue the conversation.
Well, no, that doesn't really work because I was told to call back at 844 and then they...
No. They gave you the number, but... If you go to a university, they have the number that you have. You should call when you have a problem, and you just use that number and say, "I'll call you back." It's just, you know, it's no different than I got a call from a bank. Okay, supposedly from a bank that there's a problem with my account because it seems like someone was writing checks on it and they need more information. And I said, "Fine, in my case, the bank was, you know, two blocks away." I said, "I'll come by the bank," and he hung up right away.
Well, there's all kinds of scams.
By the way, incidentally,
was a little bit different in that they said they were Apple Advanced Tech Support, and they gave me a number, and that number was traceable to a thing that almost looked like Advanced Tech Support, Apple.com. Instead, it was Apple.AdvancedTech.Support.com. Doesn't work.
Joe, you have to understand that... The reason why this continues is because they do have some degree of success. If it was zero, they wouldn't be doing it. They'll come up with a new scheme.
Well, I don't know what their formula is. Back in the days when I was in mail order marketing, our success point was 2% response.
Hmm.
That's pretty low. But 2% mail order response was success. I'm sure that they can get 2% on these calls.
Yeah, I hate to tell you, I think that seniors get hit by it.
Well, seniors do. People who are not power users like you, Hank. It's, you know, we're dealing with a thing. I don't know how to express it exactly, but we're dealing with a thing where everybody and his grandmother is being exposed to advanced technology.
Hmm.
And most of us don't know a damn thing about advanced technology, and it's easy for somebody to sweet-talk us into getting into a real problem.
Well, let me just switch over to something that is related to that. You know, last week we talked about the WannaCrypt and WannaCrypto and all that, and you had advised me afterwards that... people are coalescing around the name WannaCry, and so I just want to say that actually you should be aware of the WannaCry and all the other names because all that you have to do is just come up with a variation
spell it
on
out,
the name.
Hank.
Well,
how
in this one
Hank
is
spell it out.
WannaCry, but I showed you a message I got where it was WannaCrypto, so it's the same thing. So
if it's anything similar to wanna anything, with two N's or one N, with the word cry or the word crip or crypto, be on your guard.
Now, a big surprise that came up this week was that, according to Kaspersky Labs, 98% of the computers affected were running Windows 7, which means that only 1% of 1% of the installed XPs were affected. In other words, they weren't really affected at all. And I kind of suspected that, you know, it's not a high number because many of them are not on a public network. And then there was another article that came out, and you know who got hit hard? China. 70% of the Windows 7 users were affected, and there was a reason for it, Joe. You know what it was?
I do, because I asked you, but I think our listeners will be surprised when you tell them.
The counterfeit. Now, that should come as no surprise, because you know that...
What's counterfeit? What's counterfeit?
Well, they use the word counterfeit.
On what? What is counterfeit?
Well, wait, you're using my line. You're using my line because I said they're not counterfeit because they're a perfect copy of the original. However...
No, but you're not... Hank, it might be confusing to the audience. You're not saying that WannaCry was counterfeit or WannaCry
was counterfeit. Oh, no. I'm talking about the operating system where counterfeit was...
Windows 7.
Windows 7, let me not use the word counterfeit because it really... They're not counterfeit. They were... Because when you make a digital copy, if it's real on the source, it's going to be real on the destination part of it.
It was a real but illegal copy.
Illegal copy, and China is known for having a lot of the software being pirated. Okay, and
well, it's me that a few years ago you went to China and on a trip, and you told me that you went to a second floor suite someplace, and all they were selling were counterfeits.
Yeah, but that was the secondary story. Oh. The first story was
openly.
The first story was I had asked a cop, a local cop, how do I get there? And he says, oh, you mean, you know, such and such a place, okay? I'll take you there.
And he knew it was for counterfeit software.
Yeah, and now... Some of the stuff you could say is counterfeit, but some of the stuff, I don't know where you can buy it, okay? In other words, like some of the stuff that you would call illegal, but it's in the Chinese language that is not readily available for purchase anywhere. So what would you call that?
Well, they're obviously selling it legitimate copies that can be registered. They're selling them someplace. And somebody is taking those legitimate copies and making illegal copies of them and selling them at a cheaper price.
Mm-hmm.
The reason most of us stand opposed to this sort of thing is if everybody goes around cheating everybody else, well, what kind of a world are we living in?
Well, Joe, how about what is really... I'm going to talk about something where it's outright cheating, but it's done where a big guy is doing it and it's legal. How's that? And you know who I'm talking about?
I do. But if it's cheating, it's not legal. If it's legal, it's not cheating.
Joe, they interpreted a loophole, or they interpreted something that was a loophole. Okay, instead of having people on pins and needles, what we're talking about Google. And one of the things that I was somewhat surprised by is that I was trying to look up a song, and I was, you know, it's an old song back in the 70s, and it's called In the Summertime, okay? And the kids were growing up, and I remember...
In the good old summertime?
No.
Copyright.
Well, no. It's not in the good old summer. In the summertime, okay? Jerry, I forgot what his name is. And I go to this all these different sites, okay, and they give you a 15-second or 30-second clip of it, and then it stops, and then they say 99 cents, and well, how much they want to charge for it. And I went on YouTube, and I keyed in the title, and all of a sudden, the full song is there.
What title did you key in?
The title I was looking for, In the Summertime, okay. And it came up, and I was kind of surprised by it because I said, gee, let me try another song, and it came up again. And yet, when you're not searching for that song in YouTube, there's always a fee. There's some kind of a fee. It's like, a ringtone is a fee. Everything is fee-based now, except when you go to YouTube, if you want a real oldie or even a new song, it's there. And let me tell you what the loophole is, okay? It's a special protection for a class of material that's misleadingly called user-generated content. In other words, whoever uploaded it, it's user-generated content. And the phrase was originally intended to cover, things like your personal files that you put up on YouTube. But this year, it meant individuals uploading other people's music fell into that category. so that, you know, people were downloading it. Now, Google said that if they are told to take it down, they'll take it down, but they are not preventing anyone from uploading it because it's user content. And, of course, as you know, they could take it down, and as fast as you could take it down, it could go back right back up again.
Well, Hank, I heard about that story from Google, and so I checked a little bit further on. And I found that when it's uploaded, the uploader is making an attestation that it is not a copyrighted song and it's not an illegal upload. Once that attestation is made, it's now up to, sadly, it's up to the owner of that copyright to ask for a takedown. Once that owner asks for a takedown, even if he has not provided proof of ownership, Google will take it down instantly. This all has worked out because of a loophole that was written to protect ISPs from the content they were carrying so that they didn't have to censor each, like a telephone call is not censored. It's carried. If you want to prove that it's illegal, then you can talk Ma Bell into blocking it. Well, the ISPs have the same sort of regulation. Once again, we all make the mistake that we are good religious people, that we will never violate the Ten Commandments or the equivalent, that we'll never do wrong, and that we all are wonderful angelic-like people. Unfortunately, I've never met one of those.
Well, maybe they're really atheists.
Well, it doesn't matter. I remember when I was in service, somebody once told me there's no such thing as an atheist in an active combat zone.
Well, Joe, by the way, I want to make a statement. We are not.
Actually, they said, I got to correct myself. They said in a foxhole.
Okay. Joe, I just want to make sure that we make it plain to everyone that we are not encouraging anyone to download and save the music if it's illegal to download it. Now, when I
let me point out that on YouTube, somebody might have uploaded illegal music and somehow Google let them get away with it. That in no way makes it legal for you to download that. You have broken the law just by downloading it. Each time you listen to it, you break the law again, and I believe it's something like, I'm not sure of this, like $25,000 per listen?
I don't know what it is. But, Joe, I just want to also say that that those who are listening to us, now you know what the law is, and don't tell me that you didn't know about it. Ignorance of the law doesn't make it legal, right?
Incidentally, I'd like to ask, the Mungo Jerry song.
That's it, Mungo Jerry. That was it. In the Summertime, Mungo Jerry.
It dates back to 1970.
I said in the 1970s.
I didn't know Hank was alive that old.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1970. That would make you now when you're in your 40s, Hank. Gee.
Joe, let's put it this way. You and I were born during the Depression years, okay? You want to talk about birth dates?
Hank, I've been depressed ever since.
No. Hey, you know, people have come up to me and say, hey, you're old. And I says, hey, when I consider the alternative, I'm happy that I'm old. Right?
Well, maybe.
Mungo Jerry.
Maybe.
No, the reason why I was thinking about that song was
heard of Mungo Jerry. The song was written by Ray Dorsett, and I've never heard of him either. And the only reason I know them is, thank you, Google, but I've been looking up while Hank was talking about it. I've been going to Google for it.
No, because I remember...
Incidentally, it wasn't Mungo Jerry was not a man. It's the name of a rock band.
It's a group. Right. No, what it was that we went up to Niagara Falls with the kids during the summer, and driving up there, they were singing along, and you know, it's kind of like a happy time. You remember what it was like as a family, and you know, now that everyone's grown up and they have their own families, and you know, you think about things like that. And of course, when you get old, that's what you do, right? You reminisce about, you know, the good old days. Hey, Joe, do you know
isn't
that...
Isn't that what we started off? We started off in the good old summertime.
No. I wasn't referring to that one, okay? By the way, there's also a great song that, let me not get into that, okay? You know, Samsung and Google teamed up to come up with two new Chromebooks that is more on the high-end side. In other words, you know...
Wait. More on the high-end side?
Yes.
Oh, give me a break, Hank.
Well, let me tell you how it's high-end, okay? It's able to run Android apps. That's one thing. And they have the Google Play Store pre-installed on these two notebooks, and that you can then download the Android apps and run Android apps on a quote-unquote notebook. Now that's
I can do that on my cell phone.
I said notebook. You said cell phone. Okay.
I said cell phone. My cell phone is the only reason I can see anybody at any time dealing with a Chromebook. I'm sorry, there's two reasons. The main reason is it is cheap. The second reason is it's easy to fix when you screw it up.
What you're talking about is
a Chromebook that's more expensive than the ThinkPads I buy from Lenovo.
Well, the reason why I say it's a high end is they're convertibles. They're or the two-in-ones. You know, you can fold the keyboard under the screen, so it's like a big, thick tablet to use.
It would be about 2 inches thick. I mean, come on.
Well, but you know what the resolution is? 2400 by 1600. That's very high resolution.
It's about half of what I have on my Pixel camera.
And they weigh 2.4 pounds. That's
which
light.
Is twice as much as my I don't have a Chromebook, but I have a notepad,
and I think
they just went the wrong direction. I really do.
And it comes with two USB-C connectors, ports. Okay.
And an eight-hour battery.
And there's a micro SD card slot, but I could tell you what it doesn't have.
Doesn't have a cheap ticket.
It doesn't have an RJ45 connector. Everything is through wireless. In other words, if you want to connect to the internet, it's wireless. And you want to connect...
Well, no. You can use one of the C connectors to connect to a Ethernet. Wait a minute now.
This is one of the new ones. You have to find one of these adapters, which normally is for USB 2.0, that will be compliant with USB-C to be Ethernet. You know, no, just don't make that assumption.
Oh, no, I'm saying you can get one, and they're pretty expensive. They're $25. I tried to get one for myself. I'll wait until a cheaper version comes out. But Hank, give the suggested retail price, and you'll see why I'm being so negative.
About $450, and high-end is, with a little more oomph for using a Intel chip, is $500. That's a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
And it's not the KB Lake one.
Lenovo X1 is running around that price.
No. It's twice the price, Joe.
Yeah, I know it is. But it's crazy in my mind. I don't have to like everything you like. I don't like this one.
Oh, okay. If you don't have to like everything I like, then next time your system crashes... I don't have to help you then, right?
Yes, you do. You don't have any choice. I have a choice. You don't have a choice.
You have a choice. By the way...
One thing I'm curious about, though, there's two USB-C connectors on both of these that you're talking about, but no Thunderbolt 3.
Right.
Are you surprised that there's no Thunderbolt 3?
No, I'm not surprised, but I have to tell everyone that with USB-C ports... you got to be careful what cable you buy, because you could buy cheap cables, you could buy expensive cables. It doesn't matter whether it's cheap or expensive. Some of the USB-C cables, they don't have all the connectors wired.
I found a very cheap USB-C cable, and you tried to use it, and it worked fine, except that it did not give me the high-speed charging that my expensive cable did.
And?
I looked at the box, and it did not say anything about that.
And you know the reason for it, right? Because they didn't have all the wires connected. Or they were missing one or two strand of wires.
Or they had lousy quality control.
By the way,
sometimes you get what you pay for. Yeah. Not always, but sometimes.
Let me talk about Google, since we're talking about the Chromebook. Is that, Google works on a lot of things, and one of the things that they're building, and they hope to release it sometime this year, is a new operating system. And it's called...
Fascia. Fascia.
I thought it was Fuchsia.
No, Magenta.
I thought it was Fuchsia. How do you spell Fuchsia?
Fuchsia.
That's Fuchsia. You
call
it Fascia, okay? You Fascia, Well, now there's a reason why they're doing it, okay? They're moving away from something with a Linux kernel, and you say to yourself,
why?
Well, very simple. What happened was that there's a big court case with a $9 billion lawsuit between Sun, with Oracle, which bought out Sun Microsystem, hang on, Joe. Sun Microsystem open sourced all their stuff, but when they got taken over by Oracle, Oracle drew some of the stuff back. So that's the reason why we now have, the open office now. You have a...
But the suit against Google, Google won that suit.
Yeah, but guess what? Oracle is taking it back to court again. And that has to do with the APIs, and they're saying, well, the APIs are copywritten, since they own it now, they say they want royalties on it, and this is going to, you know what? If you're a small guy, they'll bleed you to death by going to court. However, with Google says, okay, I'll come up with another operating system, and they can do it. They can do it.
They can, but there's always a fallout on these, the unintended consequence. The unintended consequence here is going to be on the usage of the GPL. The general public license, which was what the Linux kernel was based on, is no longer general anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be used by everybody.
Hey, Joe, we're moving into the second half of the show, and I just want to tell everyone that we have some excellent... essays coming up, and I even contributed to it too, and I think you'll find it of great interest. So we're going to get to that right now.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. To start off this week, I've got another story about diabetes. As many of you know, it's a worldwide pandemic. It affects more than 400 million people, costs our healthcare systems billions of dollars every year. Basically, it's because a patient's pancreas stops producing insulin to regulate a body's blood sugar levels. Untreated can lead to all kinds of secondary problems, including blood circulation difficulties that can lead to the loss of limbs through amputation. It can lead to blindness, and it can even result in death. Dealing with diabetes is a major issue for everyone in healthcare. We've talked in the past about artificial pancreas, which typically involve a constant glucose monitoring system and then an insulin pump that responds to the levels measured by that glucose monitor and pumps out the required amount of insulin that the body needs at that point. Well, researchers have taken a new tack on this, which is kind of intriguing. They've created a special kind of optogenetic cells. Now, optogenetic, big fancy word, but basically what it is, it means that these are genetically modified cells that respond to light. So you can trigger their activity simply by illuminating them, lighting them up. In this particular case, they've created cells that, when they're exposed to light, they will produce insulin. Now, this is an experiment that have been done with rats, special rats who have been genetically bred to develop diabetes. They've been able to develop these cells that will, on demand, produce insulin. So the cool thing about it, since they respond to light, that's how you can turn them on and off. it would be possible to have the output from a constant glucose measuring sensor turn an implanted light on and off to trigger the insulin production in these cells. Now, this is a very early stage project, but it points to a future where we may be able to have a simple implant that will help regulate the blood sugar in the body around the clock and eliminate the need for finger sticks and insulin injections. The other thing is that this process of designing cells that can produce a specific chemical, not just insulin, but other chemicals that might be needed, it's possible that we could create implant systems that could help regulate other kinds of body functions. This could be a bionic solution to a variety of chronic diseases and conditions. If a patient gets injured or has some serious problem and they're taken to the hospital, there's all kinds of medical devices and tools available to doctors and healthcare workers to help understand what the problem is and to figure out what the best treatment might be. You've got X-ray machines, CAT scans, ultrasound imaging devices, all kinds of tools. Well, if you're an emergency first responder, a paramedic, or other emergency personnel, you're limited to the tools that you have available out in the field. You have stethoscope, you can take a pulse, there's some devices you can use, but things are pretty limited, and you certainly don't have access to all the sophisticated medical imaging equipment that you might have in a hospital setting. Well, that's changing. There's a company called Clarius Mobile Health, and they've created a handheld wireless ultrasound sensor. It's a transducer. Transmits and receives ultrasound waves, which are very safe. This is the same technology that we use for imaging unborn children in their mother, but it can also be used to examine internal organs, bones, all kinds of tissues and structures within the body. The cool thing about this design is that it uses a smartphone or tablet as its display. It connects to it using Bluetooth, and so there's no wires involved. The paramedics are going to have a tablet or smartphone with them as a matter of routine, and so this simply takes advantage of that display to provide medical imaging. Cool thing about this device is that it automatically sets the appropriate settings. You just tell what part of the body you want to look at, and you can then zoom in on the image, you can freeze it. It can be recorded and then sent to the cloud, where it can then be accessed by other people, such as doctors and other healthcare workers back at a hospital or other clinical setting, so you can actually consult with these experts in the field and get their advice by sharing the imaging with them. It can be used to diagnose broken bones or internal bleeding or even heart problems. So this is a very powerful tool that can help emergency personnel create a better diagnosis and start the right treatment sooner out in the field at an emergency. It's great that we have new tools like this coming along, because it's going to help save lives and produce much better outcomes for patients in emergencies. For my third story this week, I want to share the mission statement by a company called Alstone Medical. All they want to do is, quote, to save 100,000 lives and $1.5 billion in healthcare costs. Now, that sounds like a pretty ambitious goal. According to their vision statement, they plan to do this by becoming the global leader in non-invasive diagnostics for cancer, infectious disease, and inflammatory disease. Again, lofty goals, but it looks like they've got the science that can make it happen. How are they going to do this? Well, the answer is they can analyze a patient's breath for biomarkers for different kinds of diseases. The one that they're focused on initially is lung cancer. As it turns out, there are certain volatile chemicals that are more present in a patient who has lung cancer, and these can be identified. The advantage of the Alstone technology is they've got the processing confined to a tiny little lab on a microchip. It's much faster and less expensive than the traditional large equipment that's normally required to do this kind of analysis. The other thing about this technology is that it's very well suited at ignoring the chemicals in the sample that it isn't concerned with. So it can be used to focus very specifically on the target chemicals that you want. And again, it's not designed specifically for one chemical. You can actually adjust it and focus on the specific chemicals that you're interested in and separate them out from the noise of the other chemicals that are present in the breath. According to the company, they're actually able to detect chemicals at levels of as little as parts per trillion, tiny, tiny amounts of the chemical present in the sample. The company is already conducting clinical trials. They've got one in England right now, again, for the detection of lung disease. They're planning to gather samples from more than 600 patients who've been referred for lung cancer screening. And the goal is to refine the chemical profiles used to detect and diagnose the disease. Eventually, it may become that when you go for your annual wellness checkup with your doctor, you'll just breathe into a machine to give a breath sample, and it will be able to scan for all kinds of cancer, inflammation, and other diseases early on so that they can be treated more effectively and at a much lower cost, and producing much more positive outcomes for patients. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. What do Apple Computer, Hershey's, Mary Kay Cosmetics, and the Ford Motor Company have in common? These well-known corporations all started out as home-based businesses. In fact, more than half of all U.S. businesses today are based out of an owner's home. Starting a home-based business has many rewards as well as challenges. Today, many freelance workers are running some sort of small home office-based business. This varies from very modest to something that approaches a full-time operation. We also have many companies that have employees work at home. The advantage to these companies is the savings in brick and mortar to house workers. The employees benefit with such an arrangement in the savings in transportation and time expense. The downside, however, is that this intrudes into their available private living space. There are many things to consider in working at home. One is computing equipment that is needed to support the effort. There is an assortment of computing devices needed that it often overtakes the dwelling. This results in minimizing equipment that may affect efficiency of operation and actually increasing expense. Central to working or running a business at home is the computer. If you're running a business or working at home, you really should have a backup computer system available. If not, you need to have a backup system. Despite the prediction of a paperless society, you still need a printer device. Ideally, having a monochrome black and white laser printer with a separate multifunction unit device for color printing has a huge cost benefit. But space is a challenge, so many just have a multifunction printing unit. Having the extra laser printer affords you the printer backup, and if you do that, you'll probably want to install networking equipment to enable printers to be shared. Add to this computing equipment needed to run a small business. You may have a need for a UPS unit, voltage regulator, a scanner, a hub arrangement to handle more port connections than what's available on a laptop, and add to this your list of supplies such as paper, toner and ink cartridges, and your inventory of storage media. You probably have internet access for home entertainment, but you will also depend on this for your work. In all likelihood, you have more than just a single router modem unit. You'll need additional networking devices. Many could benefit with larger size and multi-screen monitors. When it comes to working with large detailed spreadsheets, the larger screen will enable you to more readily process more rows and columns without scrolling up and down the screen. That saves time. That means efficiency. Most people purchasing laptops with screen sizes 15 inches or greater really do not use them in portable mode. It's just to have it on the desktop, but it also requires less desktop real estate space, which is at a premium. Some have purchased desktop systems to have greater flexibility, but to enable them to have more space on the desktop, they place these units on the floor. This is not a good idea, as it is a traction for all dust and dirt, and I have found in many cases animal hair, such as cat and dog hair. Instead of laying out all the equipment on a single flat plane surface, consider the use of racks. Whereas equipment racks was once the domain of corporate use, they are now readily available for home use. Building and installing equipment vertically will also open up more living space room in the home. At least the home will look less as an office. Marty, what are your thoughts on rack technology in a home?
I have a riddle for you, and yes, this is about our 40-year house project, 40yearhouse.com. What's 7 feet tall and can hold, oh, close to a ton of your stuff? The answer is our new rack, a carbon rack from CyberPower. It's 45 units high. Each unit is, this is a rack standard. Each unit is 1 3/4 inches. A 45U tall rack. That's impressive, but it's not the most impressive part. I can adjust it from 22 inches to 40 inches deep. 40 inches deep. This segment today, what I want to talk to you about today are some new rack tricks, including some that this rack makes possible. There may be other racks that go this deep. I haven't found them, and I love this one. It ships knockdown, which means the rails are all going to be lined up, and you're going to have to spend some time putting it together. It comes with accessories. Get into that in a minute. But I want to talk about the tricks first, the stuff you're really going to value from this. Let's start with the idea of a freestanding open frame rack. Looks a little bit like a Rector set. It's got rails in the four corners. It's got a box at the top, a box at the bottom. It all bolts together. And the standard, one of the standards, but the most popular standard for IT and the kind of things we're doing, the standard spacing is 19 inches apart. You've probably seen equipment racks in movies or on TV, if not in the IT department at your own company. Maybe you have one. Maybe you work in radio. There are racks there, too. Those racks are designed to hold gear and layers, one above the other. Standard 19-inch depth, and you've seen the things that have the little ears that bolt into prepared screw holes on the rail. So here you go. You've got something that might be one or two or three or four, six or eight units high at the bottom, and then something above it, above it, above it. And when you hit 45 units in this one, you run out. In others, it might be 19, 15, 20, 23 units, whatever the design is. 45 units high lets me stack a lot more stuff on a single rack, but that also means you have to pay attention to the load it can carry. In this case, it's not that far short of a ton, so I'm not worried about it. Going deep, having that 40 inches makes for an unusual and very lovely advantage. Not all the stuff you put into a rack is going to use the full depth of the rack. The deepest thing we have for it, also from CyberPower, is a continuous online UPS. The way it's 2 kilowatts or 2 kVA more accurately. It's always charging its batteries no matter what's happening, and it is always as long as there's power, and its batteries are always creating the AC that it delivers. So the line power is never passed through to equipment. It's continuous online. It's also called double conversion. That big thing, if I remember right, it's about 80 pounds, is at the bottom of this rack. Why? If it's 7 feet tall, you want the weight on the bottom so the whole thing doesn't act like a swing hammer, right? It's your head, it's your gear, it's your walls. You might want to think about putting the heaviest stuff at the bottom every time you can. Now, that's deep. There's probably no room for anything behind that, even at 40 inches. Anyway, you're going to want some access to the plugs on the back. But other things are not that deep. I've seen network switches and small power units and small utility things and power distribution things and all of that that are much more shallow. And if I'm 40 inches deep, which is almost twice the depth of most standard racks, that adds several advantages, including more stability, but also including the ability to separately mount stuff on the back that doesn't need constant attention from whoever's running the stuff in the rack. Power distribution is good for that. There are other things too. Now, if you've been listening to our series, you know this rack has to do some other unusual things, like holding stacks of Raspberry Pis. Going to get to that in a second. Law of gravity in three dimensions says that if you have leveling feet, or if you put it on casters, mine's on casters, There will be a time when you move it, when something goes awry. Maybe you accidentally are running over a cable or a wedge or the cat or something. And the whole thing starts to tilt. One of the accessories for this rack is a stabilizer, kind of a kickstand, the rigid panel that extends to the floor. So it limits how far off that vertical angle can get. Leaning Tower of Pisa hasn't fallen yet. I don't want this rack falling either. That's kind of the limit on the angle. So there's another lovely little trick. Sliding shelves are, in my mind, one of the greatest improvements in racks since they started building the darn things. If I have non-rack equipment in this particular rack, I'm not going to use it for holding things like printers, scanners, which it could hold. I have a smaller rack that'll get those. But imagine having on the left half or third of a sliding rack shelf a line of 10 or 15 Raspberry Pis. Raspberry Pi is the size of a deck of cards. You need to feed it with power. You need to get Ethernet connection to it. Other than that, you may or may not need anything. Maybe audio, maybe other stuff, which means there are four sides of it with connectors you may want to access. So making a stack with spacers and then orienting the stack so the only side you don't have to access is down, using L brackets and putting it on a perforated shelf so that that stack lives in the rack and slides in and out for full access. Doesn't that save a lot of space? And you're not eating up any desktop with it, none at all. By the way, you notice I'm using only the left portion for the Raspberry Pis, which means I can put other gear in the middle that relates to the control systems. They may be hubs, they may be interfaces, they could be almost anything. The point of having that extra space is that it's not using up space elsewhere. Let's talk for a second about those little mini tower things that are in your place. The one for the cable modem, the one for the IP phone, the internet phone, the one for, I don't know, you have UVerse or Fios or one of those things, the one for the TiVo or your cable system, wherever you're getting your TV signal. All of those things are delightful to put on a shelf and look like a small landscape. Not pretty in the decor. One of the things you can do with a rack is put in a spaced shelf to hold those things. And those shelves are often slotted, so here's another little rack trick. Velcro bands through slots in those shelves can hold that equipment in place. It's not going to wobble back and forth. You're not going to be pulling connections, and you can get at it when you need to, which is, remember, hardly ever. When's the last time you looked at the internet phone modem or the VoIP system you had? Hardly ever. That rack has just become a vacuum that sucked a lot of odd pieces of gear off of countertops and floors and desktops and put it all in one place, close to the things to which it has to connect, sometimes organized, sometimes just done for convenience. But wow, so much in one place. And please note, I can feed all of that from that highly clean, highly disassociated, surge protected, pulse protected backup power system that's down at the base of the thing. Now, all the gear I'm doing has two little things happening that I have not yet solved, but I will. And those things are cooling fans that each sound like a hairdryer. It's not going to be a fun environment to work in, and it is not far from my desk. When we get to the 40-year house, it'll be in a closet, and that will help. But right now, I have to determine some way to put a sound-abating foam or acoustic batten or something near those blowers so that sound just doesn't echo all around the room. It's a bonus room, as the 40-year house will be above a garage space. In this case, it's above a two-car garage that isn't overly long. At the 40-year house, the garage is about 30 by 30, so it's a good-sized bonus room. In fact, it's several rooms in the bonus room there. A rack makes that a lot more like a real working environment. And being able to go 45 units, 7 feet tall, in many positions from both sides, it's like having two racks in one. Now, I'm sure Hank would tell you to back up your rack. Well, if you got wheels, that's not so hard. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on iPad and smartphone, Together at Last. Thursday, May 25th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Meeting will be held at Middletown Library Lodge Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PCs Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, June 1st, 7 p.m., at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, room number 101 in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their general meeting on Friday, June the 2nd. Starting time is 8 p.m. They will meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad located on 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on video and still camera technology on Tuesday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have their meeting on smartphone ride services Thursday, June 8th, 2 p.m. This is a different time from the normal time that they have their general meeting. It will be held at the Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting on Thursday, June 8th at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Mac Users Group will be meeting on Friday, June 9th at NYIT, that's New York Institute of Technology, at Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, June the 13th. Meeting time starts at 7:15 p.m. They meet at the Rasser Room of the Palisades Mall on the fourth floor, located at West Nyack, New York. And finally, the Princeton PC's Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, June the 27th, Community Room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public. They hope that you're going to be able to make some of them. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week. Thank you.